Session number 15433.
Peter McAleese, side 2. Okay, so you're in Victorian barracks at that time.
And
what, hutted accommodation or just
it was brick and, you know, big long barrack rooms and, you know, big sort of marble type sinks with heavy brass taps in them. And then there was a coal fire there. And, you know, part of your daily routine was to go and fill a coal bucket and whatnot, you know. And they were cold. You know, you'd sit there with a big pail of blankets on top of you, you know. And in the, as I say, you know, I joined in March and it was extremely cold. And then the weather picked up through May, June, July, you know.
Right. And what about the sort of people being punished or whatever it might have been there? I mean, are they putting on being put on charges or something?
Right. What you had in the depot was, again, as I was always treated extremely fair and extremely firm. I had only one charge in the depot, and I was given sort of jankers for it. You know, I got caught with some carbon on my gas plug in my rifle, and I finished up doing about 3 days. It wasn't jankers; it was some type of duties.
All right. Did you have to do all the painting of coal or the trimming of lawns with?
No, there was always this obsession for area cleaning.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things that I don't smoke, and I always found it repulsive, you know, picking up the cigarette ends.
Right.
And the other thing was, is, you know, you lived in barrack rooms, and honestly, there were, if you had to compare it now, you'd see that this never happened. Can you see that? You get floors there, and you'd pull all the floors up, then you come in, and we had those studded boots. You'd be out in the assault course, you come in and walk over the floor, can you see that? And the whole place would be scarred again, and there was just a constant cleaning, you know, to get standards up. And in actual fact, you were polishing things really that weren't worth polishing, you know. The
learning.
Aye.
Yeah.
And here go.
Just injuries and so forth. I was going to say, were there many injuries?
The with guys with a sort of sprained ankles. That was probably the main one. One guy broke his arm in training, and then it was mainly sprained ankles with me.
Because, I mean,
yeah.
That's pretty light, because, I mean, some of those assault courses, et cetera, I mean, you should get to, it's liable to get very serious.
And as I say, in the platoon I was in, it was mainly sprained ankles.
What about the did sort of cliques build up between the Geordies and the Jocks, or
no,
the... Londoners? Did people like Londoners?
No, the fact is we all had a common dislike of the Londoners.
Why was that?
You know, we all thought they were barrow boys. I mean, we were just, you know, like, whenever you saw the television those days, even the Army game, the Spiv was always a Londoner, wasn't it? You know, and, I mean, we didn't know that there were people from South London, you know, Cockneys from the East End, and, you know, we just, they're from London. If we lived in the London area, we thought they were wide boys, and believe it or not, some of them were. Some of them were wide boys, and you know they were more. They knew more about life than we did. You know, they dressed better than we did. They always had the edge on you. Well, the nightclubs and the Two Eyes, this coffee bar where Tommy Steele used to sing at that time. I mean, we spent our salary, our wages coming up to London to see a nightclub called the Two Eyes, and all it was a cafe with these little coffee things in it. You know, paid half a crown for a cup of coffee, which was a lot of money then. To see a nightclub that Tommy Steele sang in. Can you see that? There was that, and as I say, there was a sort of common dislike of the Londoner.
Did it play tricks, or?
The big thing then was if somebody brought disrepute upon the platoon, you know, the platoon tended to punish them. You know, for example, there was a guy there, he just wouldn't wash. You know, and the thing was, you'd give him a wash with bass brooms, you know. And you know, in actual fact, the guy was going to get binned anyway, so, you know, there was nothing to be gained from it. But we tended to do it because other platoons had done it in front of us, you know.
But is that just the blokes, or was that an official platoon bath?
No. It was, the NCOs never, it was done with, you know, when they were away.
With floor brushes.
And yeah. And the other thing was, they used to make up beds and they'd fold your sheets back, and you'd try to get into bed at night time and you'd be kicking into the sheets because, you know, it was folded back. It was just the sort of pranks that young men get up to. You know, as I say, we were too busy really to get up to naughty things, and you know, the sort of programme was too full. Maybe at the weekend there was a bit of it, you know.
And so you finished, you did your jumps or whatever it was. Did you like that?
Oh, I loved it. You know, and the great thing was that you got to Abingdon and the food was, it was like, in the parachute regiment at that time, you know, I can honestly say they took good food and ruined it. You know, the National Service cooks. And we got to Abingdon, and you know, people used to talk to you there. You know, they say, right, this is what we want done. So we get into these, we went to a place called Cullum first. You used to spend 2 weeks at a place called Cullum and 2 weeks at Abingdon. And the food, I mean, it was out of this world. And, you know, we went there, and there was no pressure on you. The whole thing was to do with parachuting, and it was all run by the Air Force. And your corporals then used to come with you. One of the corporals come. And we all got on fairly well together because you'd done your training, you were there to do your jumps, and you know, you'd earned your place. Can you see that? And you tended to get treated a bit better after that.
Okay. How did you find the RAF then?
I found them, in actual fact, I found them to be funny chaps. You know, they come out and they always had a joke for you, you know, and it was always, like to us, they were RAF jokes. They could only come from the RAF, you know.
They're always making... they're always cracking humorous.
Yeah, you
lines,
know,
really.
And the and plus the fact that the PGIs were, they had quite a bit of service under the belt. The guys that
the
took
jump instructors.
Aye, oh aye, and the other thing is, you know, they were Mickey takers and that. So you know, you were there all the time, and the whole thing was to get you prepared for this parachuting. And I remember we were all sitting at Cullum, and we had a bit of a card school run, you know. And one of the NCOs came in, all the cards went on top of the money, and he says, right, tomorrow morning, first bowling jump, you know. The card school just came to an end, you know. We knew it was coming, and we went there, and what happened was, we got there in the morning, and they got half the guys out in the balloon, then the weather closed in, and half of us hadn't jumped. So these guys, I mean, yeah, they'd done one jump, so they were sort of streaks ahead of us, and we're still, what light was it? And when you got to the door, did you have any trouble there on about the sound of the balloon, the swaying, you know? And so, as I say, there was only one jump between us, but we got there the next day, caught up, and, you know, these PGIs, they'd get you singing as you're going up the balloon, "Abide with me," you know, "Abide," you know, you think you're going to your doom, you know? And I mean, a balloon jump's something else. You know, you've got no aeroplane noise. You know, there's only five easy, and you're just standing, you're already kitted up, and you're stepping into space. Whereas with an aeroplane, I mean, you just charge down it, you're through the door into the slipstream, and your canopy's up. And at that time, it was, you know, but see, I always wanted to parachute, so, you know, I couldn't wait to do it. You know, it was a wee test to me.
Had you read up about it, or?
Parachuting, no.
You said you've seen it on the news. Apart from seeing this bloke walking down the road,
I get the Mickey taken out of me an awful lot, you know. And the newspapers do it. I was obsessed with parachuting, and there was a movie called The Red Berry came out in the '50s, and I followed it all through Glasgow. I just couldn't get, you know, seeing men in parachutes. You know, it fascinated me, and this is what, you know, I just couldn't wait to do this. You know.
Right.
I mean, you were defying all the laws of gravity and everything, you know, and I couldn't wait to do it.
Right. So you watch it on the films and the
newsreels. Yeah.
So where did you go? Where was your first posting after you did that? What happened after that?
Right, we came back to the depot, the parachute regiment depot, and we did continuation training.
Which consists of?
What they did is they took you on to, you know, advanced weapons, and, you know, you'd start going on to platoon and company tactics. And then you'd finish up with an exercise. It was called, I can remember the name of it, Exercise Yardstick. And it finished up with a jump onto Hankley Common. You did a platoon exercise. You did an attack, went into the defence. You did patrols, you know. And then you passed out. And from there you went to the battalion.
Okay, you still hadn't had your passing out parade?
No.
No. When did you get your red beret?
Now, at that time, the red berry was given to you when you come in.
Ah.
The parachute regiment was only 6 years old as a regiment when I got there. You know, they'd only had their colours 6 years, 54 they got them. And, or was it 52? It wasn't an old regiment, so I think they were still feeling their way through. This earning a red beret never came into the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
They gave it to you, and the big thing then was parachute wings, you know.
Had most of the NCOs and so forth had World War II experience, or then, you know, what sort of vintage and background were they from?
There was one guy there. There was about, in the depot at that time, there was about four of the platoon sergeants had been in World War II. The sergeant major, a guy called Tuvel, he'd been all through the war, and so had the majors and whatnot.
But they're all, obviously compared to now, I mean, they're in their 20s or 30s, I mean, they're young people.
Yeah. No, they were then. Were they? The World War had only finished 15 years beforehand, exactly. So, you know, if they joined when they were 18, they were only 35 as platoon sergeants. And there was one guy that I can always remember, Rocky Small. And, I mean, he was a tough man, and he was hard, and he'd been at Arnhem. And, you know, that sergeant, well, he was at Arnhem, you know, that was the big one. And you sort of, you know, we'd look at him, and you just... You know, your eyes actually opened. You know, the fact of the matter was, he had no choice in whether he was there or not. He was putting an aeroplane and transporting there. But he was a marvellous platoon sergeant. I got to know him later on in my career, and I didn't realise how marvellous a man he was. You know, in the depot, he was extremely strict. You know, but once you got to know him, he was a marvellous man. And I had a wee sergeant called Titch Turner, and his nickname was the Screaming Eagle, you know. They all had nicknames, you know. And I got an extremely experienced platoon corporal, was a guy called Scouse Tyning, and he became a very famous parachute soldier. Mm. He'd been in the Irish Guards, transferred to the Guards Parachute Company, finished his time off, and then rejoined into the parachute regiment.
Okay. So we passed out, you had a passing out parade, and then you got, where did you get posted to after that?
I got posted to one parachute battalion.
Which was based at?
Albuhera Barracks.
In
Aldershot.
Oh, right.
And as I say, I arrived over there, and you couldn't wait to get to the battalion, but there was little things, you know, like we didn't know how to wear a lanyard. You know, you'd put the lanyard on, but you didn't know whether, you know, that it was threaded through correctly. So you get over there with your red lanyard, and the first thing as you walk in, the RSM pulls you, it's on upside down. I mean, these guys used to notice things like that. And I got there, and for the first couple of days, I seen the battalion, and I was in post as a support company, which I think it was fairly unknown at that time, because normally you went to a rifle company, and support company were the old soldiers. And why I got posted there, I don't know, but I got sent to the mortar platoon, and... It was a good old platoon, but I didn't particularly enjoy it. You know, I needed to be with guys who were younger, and you know, I couldn't stand the old soldier syndrome, you know, and you get the carry on until you've jumped with a mortar, you're not one of us, and then you've jumped with a mortar. If you jump with a mortar, you're going to jump with it, you're told to jump with it. I mean, the mortars were heavy then, they weren't aluminium then, they were alloy, they were just metal mortars. You know, like to take a mortar then used to weigh about The total, you know, mortar usually weighs about £150, and 3 years had to carry it down with you. Plus, you know, there was all sorts of bits and pieces went with it. And the thing that came there was, with jumping with mortars, was, you know, you were always the first three men in the parachute stick, you know, so as the PGIs could help you up, because your containers were that big. Either mortars or machine gunners. Mortarmen or machine gunners. Then you did see... You'd done your parachute jump with a mortar. Then, you haven't done a long carry. This is when you... I mean, we used to walk behind the infantry carrying the mortars. I mean, there was... In the odd exercise, you might have a vehicle, but everything was carried by hand. And, you know, to keep up with the battalion, so the mortarmen, they tended to keep at it all the time. And, I mean, it was heavy work. Mm. But it stood me in stead for when I went to the SAS, because I was used to the weights, you know.
Okay, so...
Aye.
Your platoon there was what, the support platoon?
Mortar platoon.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay,
see, they had a support company at that time.
Oh, right.
So you had a platoon of mortars, a platoon of machine guns, a platoon of anti-tanks, and a platoon of signalers. It was called the support really? Company, yeah.
Only and the anti-tanks had what?
They had the 106s.
What's that?
It's a
recoilless
rifle. Yeah. Right. It was an American one.
And so you didn't really, that was just exercises and so forth?
Yeah.
Where were the rest of the parachute regiment based at that time?
Tupara was based in Cyprus, and 1 and 3 Para were in Aldershot.
Right. And so that was, constant exercising?
It was exercises all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And they kept you on the go. The only thing is when you got back to Aldershot, it became terribly boring. You know, and, everyone was, you know, you'd get geared up for an exercise, you go and do the exercise, you come back, clean all your kit, and then the other thing about the battalion was small, and you were constantly getting hit for duties all the time, you know, it was guards, kitchen, cookhouse, you know, and you say, you know, why did I come here? But, you know, it had to be done. You know, the fact is you don't join the army, you go to the cookhouse, you know, and work in the cookhouse. But by the same token, it's got to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we, with a smaller battalion, there was only about 400 or 500 in the battalion, and then you get your HQ company, and you know they all tend to be excused duties for various reasons. So you're probably doing the bulk of the work in the battalion with the duties 250 men in the battalion at that time, and you were getting hit all the time. You did duty company for a week, and you'd probably maybe finish up with 2 guards, and you know maybe a couple of days in the working in the cookhouse as well. You know.
Mm-hmm. And so you did that for a couple of years or something?
Yeah, I did that for about 18 months.
18 months.
Yeah.
And then your next posting was?
It wasn't a posting, I applied to go to the SAS.
Right.
And
so what was the procedure then?
We had a sergeant major called Johnson, and he was a Scotsman. Extremely firm man. But, you know, a lovely man with it, you know. So I got one day in a halt in front of him.
You got the sorry?
I halted in front of him.
All right.
And I said, "Sergeant Major, I want to go to the SES." And he said, "But we send all our shit there." And he says, "What do you want to do? Do you want to get into the jungle and start building little tents and bashers and that, you know?" And he sort of held the SES in contempt, you know. Anyway, I applied. I never heard anything. And then.
So you filled in a transfer form or whatever?
Yeah, I did. And you know, we were only young boys. We didn't know army format. You know, I submit this my most humble application to transfer to Special Air Service. Blah blah blah. You know, I am so. You know, and then they told me in December that I was going in the January course to the SAS. So I couldn't wait to get there. In fact,
what did you know about the SAS at that time?
Not a great deal. I just seen a man, and he was walking through the depot, and he had skin on him like leather. And I got to know the man later on, but he was in his mid-30s, and he was a troopie, and I couldn't understand this. He was a trooper. There was no rank, and I said, "Well, how does a guy that?" And the chap said to me, "That's the SAS. They know they're all fairly experienced guys, you know." So, as I say, I applied to go there, and that was what attracted me there. And I'd heard stories about, you know, deeds of daring do in Malaya and whatnot, you know. So, I went there, and I went on Christmas leave, and I had to go straight from home to Hereford. So in actual fact, I couldn't wait to get there.
How was home leave after you'd been? Was that your first leave, or
No, it was. I'd had a summer leave that year.
How was the leave once you got back to Glasgow, or did you go back to Glasgow?
Oh yeah, I used to go back then. Oh. And I mean, I had to go back for 48 hours then, because I used to go with a girl called Margaret Broadley,
uh-huh.
And you know, I'd been going out with her since I left school, and I'd been involved with her, and you know, I used to go home and see her, and so I always went home every chance I got, and as I say, that last leave, I couldn't wait to get to the SAS, and I came back early off leave to get to Hereford, you know.
Mm.
And I can remember to this day pulling into Hereford station. I got in the station. It was the old gas lights in the station, and the snow was about this deep. And lucky enough, they said when you arrive, they phone up the guard room. So I'd arrived early, and I came in, and it was New Year's Eve. So they took me up to the camp, and there was guys in the barrack room. They'd all be out drinking and come back. And I went to a guy called Nat Young, Nat said to me, he said, that was for, I've always been friendly with Nat since then. He took me, he says, let me get a bed. Let me get your bed. So he stuck me in this bed and these sort of wooden billets. And next thing I found myself getting tossed out of bed. It was somebody else's bed and that had put me in. And, you know, he thought the guy had gone and leave. So the next thing, you know, and this guy was a lot older than me. What are you doing in my bed? And I went, sorry, you know. Anyway, they put me up in the guard room that night. And the next morning, I went across to training wing. I moved into training wing there. And we get squadded on the 2nd of January. You know, and but the thing that got me about it then was the lack. You know, in the Paramount Reading, everybody was always getting rifted. There was always people strutting through with sticks and under their arm. There was always a sort of enforcer there. Can you see it in the form of a sergeant major, the provost sergeant? You know, you were just living in constant fear, you know. And, I mean, like, you know, everywhere you had to go to march, then times you'd maybe stick your hand in the pocket and you always get caught, you know. Like, in the parachute regiment, you always get caught. I went there, and as I say, I got there, like, I couldn't believe that everything was sort of super cool. Hello there, how are you? What's your name? Hey, Michael, he's right. What's your first name? Peter, come with me. You know, right, took me on. No, I met a chap called Tanky Smith. Tanky says, right, let me take you across to the, get you some kit. So I get in there, and there's all this magic kit getting pulled out. Heavy-duty pullovers, windproof anoraks, you know. And I said, this is terrific, you know. So and you got a rucksack. We never had rucksacks in the paras at that time. And as I say, they took us there. And then once there was 33 guys. I did the winter course. There was 33 guys turned up to do the course.
So you were there. You arrived there, and there was this party going. You found yourself another bunk, presumably.
Yeah.
And then what happened after that? I mean, did they do it? Well, they paraded you on New Year's Day, or how did it work?
No, I moved across to training wing in New Year's Day because somebody opened training wing up because the course was starting on the 2nd of January.
Right.
And I'd been there since New Year's Eve, so right. I eventually got across there, and I was the first chap in into training wing. And, you know, there was one of the NCOs, senior NCOs, was sort of floating about, catching the people coming in. Yeah.
And so what... Well, what did the syllabus consist of then?
It was, they took us in a couple of days, map reading, and, you know, give us little problems in the classroom to get us ready for map reading. And the thing that got me there was that the patience they had with you. You know, they'd say, look, you know, my map reading was atrocious. And, you know, I used to get confused with back bearings. I'd say, yeah, come on, sit down, son. Right, there is your bearing. Right, and they'd turn the compass around and say, right, there's a back bearing. You've turned it around 180 degrees. And what they did is, the preparation for the course was phenomenal. And they'd take you out for a little run in the morning, and it was cold then. It was really cold. And then the syllabus, when you actually got there, says, right, you're going to start the actual course tomorrow morning. And so we started this course. And do you know, I can't remember whether it was 10 days or how long it was, but they gave us a series of problems. The first one, they gave us a little warm-up, and we walked over the Malvern Hills. And I can distinctly remember there was a load of Cameron Highlanders had actually applied to join the SAS to get back to the UK. One of them got off a truck, and this is the Malvern Hills, not the Black Mountains or the Brecon Beacons. He says, this is not for me. You know, he was deeply tanned, you know, deliberately failed a course and got himself a bit of leave before he went back to Singapore. That's the way it was at that time. Anyway, we did a series of marches, and honestly, I was extremely fit. If I could see something, like, I could make time on it. But, you know, I used to get maps, and, you know...
How do you mean make time?
Like, we did this thing called Fan Dance, mm-hmm. and it was, you had to go, cross over the top of Penny Fan, which is the highest mountain in South Wales. You crossed over it three times. You went from Coomgoodie Ranges, the top of Penny Fan, to Panto Station. Terpanto Station, top of Penny Fan, to Story Arms. Story Arms to top of Penny Fan, to Coomgoodie. Can you see that? So there was three crosses
up and
over
down
the top.
Three times,
So the first two times I could see it, and one of the instructors went, "Well done, you're doing well." And I was in the last leg, going, back, I think I was going down to Story Arms on the last leg. I'd done it a different way about. And the mist came down.
And you couldn't see.
And I got my compass out and I went, I was going that way, I was going that way. You know, and I kept, and I went, and you know, something kept dragging me to the right, you know. And then, all of a sudden, I seen a set of footsteps there. A set of footprints in front of me. I said, and I looked and I put my boot in it. It was my boot. I'd walked around in a circle. And so I had to make all this time up again. And I said, it's the compass. So I shot right down. And I wasn't extremely good in selection. I was fit. I was fit for selection. But, you know, my map reading, what I knew about it, was dangerous. And then what they did then was they gave me a sketch map to do. And the sketch map was just a piece of foolscap paper with, and everything was to scale on it, but you know, there was an awful lot eliminated from it. So there was a trig point, a lake at one place, you know, and the great thing about that was I had to use my compass. You couldn't map read. See, I'd been trying to map read, and that way I got my compass and I went, that's it, and I made it, and I hit the place smack on.
All right.
And that is when it came right. It came right for me about halfway through the course.
Right. Okay.
And we, you know, as I say, I passed selection, just passed it. You know, I never passed that selection with flying colours.
And how long, I mean, what about night marches and all the rest of it?
Right. Every day tend to be a night march, because if you missed an RV, you know, you were, it was the winter, it was dark at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
So consequently, the last part of the day, you were in the night march, but the continuation train.
Mm.
Oh, you know, honestly, I have never in my life took part in exercises with such imagination used as I took there. In continuation training, we were never told to march. You know, like you get this Foreign Legion type, they just march for the sake of marching. They always had purpose. Then, you know, they say, right, you're going to so-and-so, you've got to meet an enemy agent. An agent. He will pass you on to a safe house. You'll stay at the safe house for one night. You'll be briefed on what to do the next day. And you get passed through an escape evasion network. It was always exciting. Like, you know, for example...
How long did the basic training last?
I did... At that time, we were going into the unknown.
Or selection. Yeah.
The selection, I think it was... The whole thing took 2 weeks, but the actual... selection part of it was 10 days.
Uh-huh. And what percentage got through?
There was 33 of us started, 7 of us passed, of which there were 4 recourses. So in actual fact, if you take it 30 people, 3 actually passed it out of the 30, because the other ones were recourses. Can you see that?
Recourse means what?
They'd done the course before and hadn't done as well as they should.
Okay.
But done well enough to be kept on to do another course.
Okay. Right, yeah. To try again,
yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
And, okay, so you then you had the continuation training. How long did that last?
That was, as I say, I did the longest, at that time, the longest selection course. It was in the British Army, in the SAS. My course started in the 1st of January, 2nd of January, and it finished mid-July. So, you know, during the training, what they're trying to do is get us totally trained to go and join the squadrons. So I actually did my jungle training then, which you never did before. It was normally done in the squadron.
Mm.
So at that time, I went from basic training to jungle training to continuation training. And then we went on the escape and evasion in Denmark. And the CO said, I think we better put these guys in the squadron. It just didn't seem to be working out at that time, because... You had as many instructors as you had personnel. Can you see that?
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's sort of...
So how many were you in your little group then?
When we finished up?
Hmm.
7.
Only 7, aye. Yeah. And they were bidding people and returning people to units and all the rest of it.
The majority of them, the guys, binned themselves.
Is it bad enough?
Yeah, yeah. You know, like... you know, what was left at the end of the course, they'd say, okay, you haven't passed, but, you know, we feel you should try again. But the majority of guys bin themselves on it.
Yeah. Okay. And so what other subjects were they taking in the continuation training?
Right, we did introduction to demolitions. We did escape and evasion. We did signals, as it was called, not communications.
Mm. Well, was that Morse or?
Morse, yeah. Morse. We did the Browning machine gun, you know, because the army.
50 caliber or?
No, 30 caliber.
30 caliber.
We tended to use that at the time. And then you were always getting. And it was constantly doing exercises to incorporate in all these things. Like, as I say, there was one exercise we started off, and I mean, the battle picture was phenomenal. And I can remember walking over the mountains, and we were supposed to get picked up by a submarine at Aberystwyth. And I came over the hills, and I could just see the sunshine. I said, what beauty. Unbeknown to me, the exercise had been so exciting. We'd marched 80 miles.
And how far?
And how long? Yeah. It was over, say, I think it was a 36-hour period. But, you know, yeah. You know, we were lining up on that, you know, and whatnot. And
I think we're coming to the end of this, yeah. Right.